Welcome to the Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. Got Ellen Brown on today. I say it all the time. Ellen does some of the best financial writing anywhere. We'll talk about some of it on the program. And Ellen wrote the definitive book on the banking system, the private banking system, how it was stolen from us. You know, the Wall Street crooks. I'll make a comment about an article I wrote this morning. I'll get it out tomorrow. Ellen explained how these so-and-sos, these crooks, that's all you can call them. A crook is a crook. What else are you going to call them? They usurp the money creation power. And Ellen explains how they did it and how we can get it back. Well, my article for tomorrow through Friday, don't know the hour of the day, but through Friday, the Treasury crook in chief, that's a good title for him. Instead of calling him a secretary, call him a crook-in-chief, Timothy Geithner. He stepped down. His replacement, the new crook-in-chief, will take his place, Jack Lew. He's had a lot of experience. Geithner had a lot of experience. I call my article for tomorrow, Tim Geithner's Legacy of Shame. I was being kind. I mean, it's that and a whole lot more. I mean, his resume, it can only be described as a scoundrel resume. Various Treasury Department posts, president of the New York Federal Reserve Bank, the mother bank, more important than the other 11 combined. That's where all the big Wall Street banks are. He was the president of the bank for a few years. He worked for the IMF. He held an economics position at the Council on Foreign Relations. It goes on and on and on and on. And then from the beginning of Obama's administration, 2009, until Friday, he was Treasury crook-in-chief. Well, he's gone, but the legacy lingers on, very sadly. Anyway, I wrote a short article. I just kind of encapsulated the essence of Tim Geithner. And I wrote a separate article a week or two ago on Jack Lew and his credentials. He was a thief at Citigroup, and Geithner absolutely is a mega thief. Fed Chairman Bernanke, partners in crime. Isn't that the way it always works? Ellen, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Stephen.
Oh, I could go on and on and on. Your latest, you wrote an article that is very easy to slip under the radar. You wrote an article about the trillion-dollar coin, but it's something that should not slip under the radar because it's not a silly idea. I don't know that we're going to get a trillion-dollar coin, but it's not a silly idea. Explain why it has some significance or could have some significance if we actually did come up with one of these. One wouldn't be too bad, and if we had one, Ellen, it's an entree to more.
Right. Well, the reason that the issue came up was that because of the debt ceiling, which is an artificial constraint on the Treasury paying the bills that Congress has already incurred, which the Treasury is actually required to do under the Constitution. So the debt ceiling itself is a bogus sort of political ploy, and so it had been suggested. Well, I actually first suggested the trillion-dollar coin, I think, in 2007 in Web of Debt, and I got the idea from somebody on the subcommittee for coinage in the early 1980s, and he pointed out that the Congress. According to the Constitution, Congress shall have the power to coin money and regulate the value thereof, and no cap is put on the size of the coins or the face amount of the coins. I mean, the amount of the coins or the face amount of the coins. And so we could arguably pay off the whole debt with, he said, some billion-dollar coins, and then I said today we'd have to do trillion-dollar coins. Like $16 trillion coins would pay off the whole federal debt. But that was all just kind of theory, and then it was another man who went under the name of Beowulf picked it up. He's actually an attorney, Carlos Mucha, I think, who said that actually after that they did put a cap on most of the coins, but they left one open, and that was a platinum coin, and this was for commemorative purposes. But who knows what that means? Why did they leave it open? It seems like they might have left a loophole there just for this purpose. Anyway, you could without having to go to Congress, which is the problem. You know, Congress is deadlocked. So anything, people say, well, we think you could do U.S. notes. You could, but you'd have to go to Congress to get them to issue it. But the executive itself or the treasury itself could issue a $1 trillion coin without any change in the rules, just by executive order. And that could be sort of a checkmate to the debt ceiling. And in fact, after I wrote that article, they did lift the debt ceiling. So who knows? Maybe, you know, maybe they are feeling threatened by the coin.
Well, they will raise the debt ceiling. I mean, it happens automatically. It's almost a pro forma exercise. And the idea that there's a debt crisis, as you say, Ellen, it's absolutely phony. A $1 trillion coin will be very real. Phony as a $3 bill if we ever had one. We did have one at one time. I remember $3 bills in my wallet. I guess it was too confusing, so they got rid of them. But the idea of a fiscal cliff and a debt ceiling, absolute phony baloney. I mean, Japan's debt is more than double the U.S. debt, and Japan hasn't disappeared lately. I think Japan is still there, Ellen, last time I checked.
Right, and they're actually doing very well in terms of exports. So I actually have a whole chapter on that. I think it's rather bogus that the way of the Japanese is to feign poverty in order to be able to get away with borrowing from their own central bank. So they're basically, and their own Japan Post Bank, they're basically borrowing from themselves so they can go into debt as much as they want. The interest goes to their people, so the interest is like Social Security. It's the savings of the people are earning interest from the government itself. So it's all a self-contained system. It's perfectly fine to go into debt in that situation. But it seems to me the problem with our whole debt, or the reason, the significance of the $1 trillion coin is not just as this sort of political gamesmanship, but that in the 19th century, there were actually two ways that money got into the money supply. One was through private banks as banknotes, and the other was through the treasury with coins. And at that time, coins were actually a fairly large part of the money supply. In fact, you were supposed to back your banknotes were supposed to be have coins in the bank to back them. But the coins got shrunk to where they are now only, I think it's $1 billion. All the coins are only $1 billion. So it's just a minuscule portion of the money supply. And all of the rest is created by banks as loans. And, of course, the problem with bank-created money, it's only credit. And it's all owed back. And worse, it's all owed back at interest. So we have this continually spiraling pyramid of debt that is impossible to pay off. I mean, we have this whole debt crisis artificially because our money is created private. We don't have any money. There's not really any money in the system. It's all just this mirror reflection of debt upon debt. The only real money is the base money that's in the Fed's, in the Federal Reserve accounts that are kept at the Fed, but they're the bank reserve accounts. We have absolutely no access to those reserve accounts. So we have no access to base money. I have this image of it's just this big house of mirrors or Plato's cave, you know, where we're working with the shadow money, and the real money is all there on the Fed's, the bank's Federal Reserve accounts. So even that $2 trillion that went into the Federal Reserve accounts cannot and will not ever make it into the consumer economy because it never leaves those accounts. It's just there to clear checks. So anyway, we have this whole artificial bogus system all stemming from the Federal Reserve, which is the head. Well, it's composed of 12 branches, all of which are 100% owned by the private banks in their district. In other words, it's federal in name only. The heads are appointed by the federal government, but other than that, they're not responsible to the federal government. They report, but it's just like, this is what we've just done. They don't report and take commands. They just give commands or they give reports. So you could correct all that by making the treasury system much bigger. The one that actually puts real money into the system is the treasury, which puts coins out there which do not come into the system as a debt. They're out there for good. The Treasury could, of course, a trillion-dollar coin, nobody could make change for it. But what you could do is put it in the government's reserve, government's account at the Federal Reserve, and then the Treasury just writes checks against it for its bills, which is what they do anyway. They write checks against their account, but they go into deficit, and then it's a big issue every year because, oh, no, we've run up the deficit. We have to balance our books, which means we have to cut back on services, which is not what it means. So anyway, we could have a positive balance instead of a negative balance, clean all that up, and we could eliminate $500 billion in interest every year that we pay, we the people pay on this debt, half of which is held by us in the form of Social Security, et cetera. I mean, it's the whole system is messed up, and it's all based on this house of mirrors thing that's all built on debt. And we could fix that with some real money.
We could fix it so easily, Ellen. That really is the disturbing part of the story. It's a snap to take a dysfunctional system and make it supremely workable, but it isn't done because the bankers pretty much control things. Washington is Wall Street occupied territory. I mean, it goes on and on and on. It doesn't matter who the Treasury Secretary is, Hank Paulson under Bush, Geithner under Obama, Jack Lew coming in, it could be the man in the moon, the same system goes on, but it really could be made functional. The economy could become prosperous. I mean, it really is incredible because a prosperous economy benefits everybody. And I've said a number of times in articles I've written that a prosperous economy creates jobs. Jobs puts money in people's pockets. When people have money, they spend it. The economy keeps growing. I mean, it's a wonderful revolving, upwardly lifting, positive cycle. And we don't have it because the crooks that are running the country, the money control crooks, they want all of the revenue, all of the benefits circulating one way. It goes to the very top, a fraction of the top 1%, and everybody else pays a terrible price for this. And none of it has to happen, but that's the system, and that's what we've got. And people need to understand it, and it'll never change, Ellen, unless people understand enough to realize they're not going to take this anymore. And people have the power in their own hands to change the system if they'd only use the power that they have. We talk about it a lot on this program, did yesterday, here again, mentioning it today. The people are the real superpower. Mm-hmm. They just don't realize it, and they don't do anything about it.
Yeah. If you look at all the revolutions in history, they used to always be violent, or pretty much always be violent revolutions. But we can't do a violent revolution now. In fact, I think they're trying to provoke a violent revolution because they want the opportunity to impose martial law because they know that that's the only way they can control the people who are starting to wake up to who the real crooks are, what's really happening in our system, how skewed the whole system is and how easily it could be fixed if we had the right people in there. But everybody can see we don't have a chance of getting our people in there because we don't have the money to get them elected. It takes money, and they have the power to create the money. So there would be this temptation to have a violent revolution. And in fact, I just saw a really good video yesterday about Sandy Hook. I'm not really confident to speak on that, but the video said, you know, the man suggested that it all looks so bogus. I mean, there's so much furor over what appears to be a psyop, you know, the fact that they remade the whole city in the last 3 years and all the storefronts went up at once. And there are just so many mysterious things about that whole case that it looks like an intentional provocation of the gun people in order to get them to fire their guns so that there will be an excuse for the military to come in and impose martial law, because that's the only way they're going to keep control of a people that is getting smarter and smarter with the internet and with, you know, just the explosion of knowledge these days. So I don't know if that's true, but it certainly, you know, I can't resist a good conspiracy theory, so I have to keep watching this stuff.
We exchanged a few emails on that prior to the program. I think it's very possible, Ellen. The idea that eventually, at some point, don't know when it'll happen, but I've written in previous articles that I think the reasoning in Washington is that conditions are so bad, and the plan is to make them worse, not better.
Yeah.
So the mass suffering, the poverty, the unemployment, the real numbers, not the fake ones that get put out by the Labor Department, the Commerce Department, all the other departments, but the real numbers that explain things, that this serious human suffering going on in the country is getting worse and worse and worse, and eventually the pain will probably reach a certain threshold that people will react. How will they react? Nobody knows, but it could be. I mean, the history of the world has violent revolutions in it. People take so much, and then you get an explosion. America's revolution was a phony one. That wasn't a good example. But the Russian Revolution, the French Revolution, other resolutions, I mean, there was real pain that got people to react. It could happen in America. Why not? America is no different than any other country. It could happen, and they want to be ready. They want to be ready. They want to be ready to defang the public from doing anything about their misery. So there's a lot of things they can do. I guess take away people's guns is one. Stoke fear that you get an outside enemy. Don't worry about your pain at home. You know, you've got terrorists under your bed or around the corner or across the border, so you really need to do something about them. That's part of the scheme.
So
ugly stuff, Ellen.
You need like policemen in every theater, because there might be a crazy person in there who might shoot everybody. And you need policemen in the schools, and you need drones, and you know, you need that all for your own protection. But of course, that's all to keep us from rebelling.
Well, absolutely. As far as drones go, and it must be 6 months or more since I wrote about this, but there is a plan to put spies in the sky over America. Of course, there are drones used to kill people around the world, various countries, and the program is expanding greatly. If I remember the number right, in an article I wrote some months ago, I think it said that one out of every three U.S. aircraft is a drone, and the plan is to replace more of the piloted aircraft with pilotless aircraft. It's a lot cheaper. It's a lot cheaper all the way around. U.S. Forces don't get killed. You shoot down a drone, you know, you lose a million or two or three, whatever they cost. Shoot down an F-16, I don't know how many tens of millions it costs, but a lot more than a drone. But they want to do the same thing in America, to spy on people. But they're going to use the same kind of predator drones. They can easily put missiles on them. They can spy. They can watch us. They can do anything they want. And the idea is to keep a close watch on what people are doing. And if it looks like there's some kind of stirrings going on, they can take whatever measures they want. And who says they wouldn't put missiles on the drones and shoot them at people if they thought that was the way they had to put down a rebellion? I don't see why they wouldn't do it, Ellen.
I read somewhere, and I don't know if this is true either, but that the reason for the chemtrails is that they've got this whole aluminum sort of layer over the whole Earth now, and that acts as a, you can bounce signals off that, and it's a way of spying on the people. In other words, you can get intelligence on what's going on through this sort of artificial shield that's been imposed all around the world. I don't know if that's true, but it's another great conspiracy theory. But
go ahead. I was just going to say that spying is literally institutionalized. It's not only done abroad, virtually anywhere America wants to do it. It's done at home. It's done against nonviolent civilians for any reason. Warrantless searches, I've written a number of articles on it. There are lawsuits about this. The CIA does it. The Pentagon does it. Literally mass surveillance, Big Brother in the sky watching us. And this is very serious stuff. They literally want to know everything we're doing. It's been a while, but I've written past articles that every part of our lives can be looked into. They can easily, when I say they, the government, whoever we do it, FBI, CIA, the rest of them, they can access our medical records, our financial records, anything about us. It's shocking. I mean, the idea of privacy in America is absolutely gone. It's a non-starter. And again, it's the idea of keeping a watch on us to be sure that if anything stirs up that's going to mess up their control of the system, they want to be ready to react any way possible, including doing it violently against us. And they're in cahoots with state and local governments, and they're militarizing them. I've written about that, militarizing local police forces. These people stop at nothing, Ellen, to get what they want. I mean, talk about a police state. America is a police state.
Yeah, I would agree, but being the eternal optimist, I do think it's because they're reacting so strongly because they've actually lost. On some level, they've lost. They can't keep control merely by the media, merely by an illusion of what's really happening, you know, where money comes from and why the rich are rich and the poor are poor. We're figuring it out, and we would overthrow the system but for this violent suppression. But then the question is, what do we do about it? I mean, I really don't think we should even consider, or I mean, I certainly don't consider it. I would never own a gun in my life, but I don't think we should consider, people shouldn't consider violent rebellion, because that is going to provoke the police state. But I guess you're right, we've already got one. But anyway, it seems to me we have to do it legally, and it can be done. For example, the trillion-dollar coin is one way to do it. And if you look in history, there are certain revolutions that have been quite peaceful, and how they did it was by a mass popular movement, a mass understanding of what was going on. For example, in New Zealand, there were, I just wrote about this in the book that I really hope to get out very soon.
Well,
on public banking.
I do hope you'll get it out real soon. On public banking, of course.
Yes. So in Australia, and Australia came up with this great system where they had a truly public bank, and the head of the bank understood how banking worked. He was a banker, and he used that for the benefit of the people, and he issued credit for all good things and did wonderful things for Australia. But he made the mistake of going to England and boasting about this at the City of London, and that totally alarmed them, and they came up with this new central banking system where the central banks would issue the money instead of the government, and the central banks would be under the control of the Bank of England as the head. Now it's the Bank of International Settlements, which looks more subtle, but it's really the same system. But in New Zealand, so the same man that went to Australia and set up that system there then went to New Zealand, Sir Otto Niemeyer of the Bank of England, governor of the Bank of England, and set up a central bank there. But because C.H. Douglas had actually gotten there first, he's the head of social credit, the founder of social credit, and there was a big social credit movement. Their money reformers understood the money system and what could be done with it. So they took this central bank that had just been set up, and they got control of the government, basically, or, you know, there was a populist movement that was so strong that the government had to listen to them, and they started doing the same thing where they issued credit, not backed by gold, not backed by borrowings, but just the credit of the nation in order to build housing and support the dairy industry, the things that were important then. It was like local subsidized housing, government housing, and so they got this money interest free, and because it, you know, came from the government's own bank. But then they did pay it back, like this, the housing they paid back with the rents. But basically what they did was issue the credit first, build the thing, and then they had a producing asset, and then the asset paid back the initial investment, and that worked great until the Bank of England once again leaned on them and made them desist from these silly practices, as was said. And that happened many places, and in fact, it happened in places that were not under the thumb of the Commonwealth, such as Japan, I mean the British Commonwealth, such as Japan. And the contention is, which I'm hesitant to quote, but I am quoting it, that's what got them embroiled in World War II. It had to be stopped one way or another. So now the Japanese do it very much more subtly. They do it by borrowing from themselves, but it's still the same thing. They're still just issuing money. And the Chinese are doing the same thing. They're just issuing the money. They make it look like they're borrowing, but we don't get to see their accountings. And they own the banks, so they're issuing their own money and subsidizing their industries, which is why our industry, there's no way our industries can compete with Chinese industries, and that's because they subsidize them, and we don't. So they can make, they can always undercut our price.
We not only don't subsidize our industries, we ship them to China, Ellen.
Yeah.
a big point about debt, and you've raised it, the big difference between U.S. debt or Japanese debt, the debt is owed to ourselves, to themselves. You get in trouble with debt when you owe it to somebody else. But if you owe it to yourself, you can keep running up all the debt you want. I mean, the Fed has created all these trillions of dollars. The Fed could create double that amount, triple that amount. I don't know what the limit is. I mean, sooner or later you do crazy things and you're going to pay a price for it. But Japan hasn't hit the ceiling yet. But so when you owe all this money to somebody else and they demand the payment back, I guess that's when you can get into trouble.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Anyway, the Fed has a limitless money printing machine, so it literally can create all the money it wants. The key thing as far as the economy goes is, what do you do with it? I mean, do you bail out banks or do you grow the economy? And we know the route that was taken, the wrong route.
And the way the Federal Reserve Act is set up, it's not even an option. The Federal Reserve does not have the option of doing like what Roosevelt did in the 1930s with the Reconstruction Finance Corporation. He couldn't use the Federal Reserve. He used a different entity, a publicly owned financial institution, which then could fund all these businesses that got, you know, people hiring again and funded housing and all these things in the economy. The Federal Reserve, it's not in their mandate. In fact, Ben Bernanke was asked that. Why didn't he do some quantitative easing for, you know, make loans to the local governments that were suffering because of the banking crisis? And he said, well, if Congress wanted him to do that, they would have to change the law because it wasn't in the Federal Reserve Act. That act is, the whole thing is set up to serve the banks. The Federal Reserve is there to backstop the banks because in the 19th century they kept having runs on the banks because, you know, they kept getting caught in this whole fractional reserve fraud that they were pulling off, but they needed the fraud. I mean, you can see it two ways. On the one hand, they were privately collecting interest on money they didn't really have, and that was fraudulent. But on the other hand, there was a huge demand for this credit because you needed to expand the money supply. You needed to get credit out there. So that's why I'm arguing not to get rid of the banks, but to get some public banks. In other words, if the interest goes back to the public, then it's not a fraud. It's, you're just creating the credit of the community, lending it into the community, and it comes back to the community for community purposes.
Absolutely, Ellen. And maybe the Fed is right. I mean, the Fed is a private entity. It has nothing to do with the federal government. An awful lot of people know that, but I guess still too many do not know it. But that is true. But even as a private entity can loan money to any source it wishes. So the idea that the Fed says it can't loan money to states, well, private banks can loan money to states, to cities, to you, me, to your neighbor, to anybody. They can do whatever they want. They're private. There's no restriction on what they can do. So the Fed could do it too. They just don't want to do it. The idea with the Fed is you take care of your own. You don't worry about anybody else. Let's take a quick break, and we'll come right back. Welcome back on with Ellen Brown. Ellen, I wrote a couple of other articles relating to the economy. I mentioned I wrote about Jack Lew, the incoming Treasury Secretary. He needs to be confirmed, but it'll be a slam dunk. He won't have any problems. We've got other nominees coming in. There's usually a personnel turnover between terms of administrations. So John Kerry will be easily confirmed as Secretary of State. You've got a debacle going on about Hagel for defense, but he won't have any trouble. You know, the Republicans will kick up a little dust. They'll say he's not friendly enough to Israel. Nonsense. Nobody gets nominated for a high government position unless they're considered safe. Safe means they go along with the corrupted system. They follow it. It's the same power structure, the same money-driven power structure that runs the country, that runs the world, that wants to run all of it, all the parts it doesn't completely control, and that's the system. And nobody gets into a power position, which means anything in an administration, a key position in Congress, or an appointed bureaucratic position, unless they're safe. And these people are absolutely safe. I wrote about the incoming, the nominee for SEC chief, head of the SEC, Security and Exchange Commission, Mary Jo White. Gee, I never really knew much about Mary Jo White until she got nominated. She's the same as her predecessor, Mary Shapiro. Mary Shapiro was a consummate insider. So was Mary Jo White. Her husband is a walking conflict of interest. Mary Jo worked for a law firm that defended the biggest crooks on Wall Street. That was her job at the firm. She was in government. She was out of government. The firm defended the Wall Street crooks, Bank of America, HSBC, J.P. Morgan, you know the usual suspects. And her husband works for another law firm. He works for a law firm in New York. They're both in New York, I believe. And he represents a very strong conflict of interest. His job is lobbying for deregulation. In other words, get out of the way. Let the bankers, let all the other corporate interests do whatever they want, regulatory free. Well, Mary Jo, with him at the law firm in New York and Mary Jo at the SEC. Well, bankers have nothing to worry about. So a takeoff from the Wall Street ad, from the Allstate, it rhymes with Wall Street, from the Allstate ad. My article that went out yesterday was called "Wall Street's in Good Hands with Mary Jo White." Well, you can bet your life she never would have been nominated if that wasn't the case. They have nothing to worry about from her. Yeah. She won't lay a glove on them. Her job is to protect them, not pursue them. That's part of the dirty system, Ellen. So dirty.
Well, that's why they said they wouldn't do the trillion-dollar coin, because the Federal Reserve said they wouldn't take the coin. Well, why? But it's legal tender. How can we allow the Federal Reserve to tell us they're not going to take our legal tender? Seems to me what the Treasury should do then is say, well, we want the coin, so we're going to set up our own bank, and we don't necessarily need to deal with the Federal Reserve. But they won't. Like you say, it's all a cover for doing what they want to do already.
Well, there really is a cover, because if there really were legitimate people running the country, they don't need a trillion-dollar coin. They don't need any hocus pocus. They could simply change the system. I mean, they could change the language of the Constitution or interpret it a different way. Decide that coins means money, and the idea is that only the government create its own money. I mean, anybody listening, just think about this for a minute. If they don't understand the system, does it make any sense in the world that the government should pay interest on its own money? The government pays interest on its own money. I mean, talk about craziness. The government should create money interest-free for itself. And if it was interest-free, I mean, it wouldn't have to be low interest now. Of course, it's low interest for a business interest and for the Fed. You know, they can sell treasury bills almost at minus percent interest, and 10-year bonds, 10-year bonds at about under $2, maybe $1.80, $1.85, 30-year bonds, maybe 3%. Gee, I never remember any time of my life right now when that happened. It seems crazy. I can remember. I mean, back in the 1980s, you could get a treasury note for 15% interest. You could get a treasury bill and get more interest. It was incredible. I mean, it would talk about easy, free money. It was there for the taking. But now, and of course, the government paid a lot of interest on its own money then. But why should the government have to pay any interest at all? It shouldn't. But that's the system. That's the way it's set up. Congress could change it easily if they wanted to. They don't want to, so we're stuck with it, Ellen.
Mm-hmm. And there's the half of the money supply that's created by banks, but there's another half that's not even created by banks. It's created in the shadow banking system. In fact, it's more than half. At its peak, it was $20 trillion. And what they do is they take collateral, which is like U.S. Treasuries. These are hedge funds, et cetera, that are using this to create credit. Every time you create credit or make a loan, you're actually creating money because it's now in two accounts at once. I mean, you say you still own the money, but you've lent it out to someone else, or the bank says it's still in the depositor's account, but at the same time they've lent it out to someone else. So they've expanded the money supply. Well, they do that in the shadow system the very same way. So they take these U.S. treasuries and they use those to back a loan, say for a hedge fund to speculate with, and then the party that gets the collateral can then use that again for another loan. And so they leverage these loans upon loans upon loans. So they have this huge pyramid of debt upon debt upon debt, and it's based on nothing. I mean, it's based on the collateral itself is a form of promissory note or a form of debt. So there's no real money anywhere in this system. And that's why we can't possibly sustain it. That's why everybody's in debt. The government's in debt. Look at Europe, which is the classic case, because they don't even have a central bank that can issue their money. They can only get the money from the European Central Bank, and the European Central Bank, the Maastricht Treaty says right in there that the ECB cannot lend to governments. It specifically says, you know, we're not here to lend to governments. We lend to banks, only to banks. So then the banks get to lend to the government. So the ECB can lend very cheaply to the banks. They were doing 1% loans for the banks. And then the banks would lend it on at anything they wanted to charge or whatever they could get away with charging. Or they would lend it to investors who would then lend it on, you know, at 30% to Greece or whatever. So the whole system is bad, and it can all be fixed mathematically. Abundance could be ours. And the interesting thing is, in half the world, they know that, and they're actually doing it. And they're like sort of slipping out of our net without, you know, very quietly, because they're not stupid, so then they don't want to provoke a world war like they did before. So they're very quietly going about their business, issuing their own money. Argentina is actually a really interesting case. That's what they did, and now they're getting trounced with these bogus, supposedly protests, but the protests were all stimulated by the people that wanted to stop the government from escaping the credit net and just issuing their own money.
Well, Argentina, over a decade ago, discovered that they could get out of a terrible financial crisis by simply telling their creditors, take a hike. We'll give you so many cents on the dollar, take it or leave it. Most took it, some didn't. Years later, most of the ones who didn't take it ended up taking it, but they came out of their terrible debacle, and they became, for a time, the continent's fastest-growing economy. The European system, the Eurozone, the 17 Eurozone countries, that really is a crazy system, Ellen. I mean, talk about a system designed to fail. And Bernard Carnally, I think the man's name was, if I can remember him, I wrote about him. He's in my book, Banker Occupation. Been so long. He was the Euro expert. He wrote a book on the Euro system back before the Euro actually came into existence. And I mean, he was the man who understood it best. And he said this system absolutely is designed to fail. There's no way in the world it can succeed. It's just a matter of time when it will fail. And who ever heard of a system with sovereign countries? First of all, you've got mismatched countries in the same economic sphere. So you've got powerhouse Germany matched up with basket case Greece even before the economic financial crisis. Simply made no sense in the world. But you've got these countries lined up with each other, and all 17 of them sacrificed their national sovereign, their national fiscal and monetary sovereignty to a foreign entity, the European Central Bank. You could call it anything you want, but who ever heard of doing anything like that? So they literally have no control over their money system, whether it's monetary or fiscal, and the system says you have to do what the ECB says. And the ECB only works for the bankers, not for the countries. So you've got a terrible system. You've got countries in crisis. Greece is the worst, but Spain is in terrible crisis. Unemployment keeps going up. Portugal, Ireland, Italy. Sooner or later, they might all be in crisis. But again, it's a system designed to fail. And
It's not really failing for the banks. It's succeeding, except that it's going to be overthrown. I mean, the banks are taking over, and part of the whole deal when you're in debt is that you're forced. If you get a loan from a regular bank, you can just default on it. But if you get a loan from the IMF or the European Stability Mechanism, which is the new thing that's being set up to, you know, for supposedly bailing out these governments, but the deal is you only get the loan if you agree to all kinds of austerity measures, and one of them is you sell off your private banks. Right now, I saw that in Greece they're protesting because they have public banks. They have public banks all over Europe, but they're forcing them to be privatized. They're privatizing their post office, and the Greek people are dead against it. Of course, they've had that public post office for a long time, and it serves the people. It's the bank of the people. It's the place where ordinary people go to deposit their money and have a safe place to write checks and keep their money.
Oh, indeed. Well, not to sell off their public banks, but sell off all the crown jewels.
Everything public, right.
Yeah, everything public. You know, sell the railroad, sell the Parthenon, sell the ports, sell everything, the crown jewels, sell it off at fire sale prices. Talk about grand theft on a grander than ever scale, and this is what's going on. And, of course, Greece is one country. They want all the other countries to do it. And the ECB can take care of the banks, but the sovereign countries are on their own, and they're in lots of trouble. Oh, it's a race to the bottom, Ellen, and there seems to be no end to it. Again, very, very ugly, very, very, very self-destructive. And the bankers are loving it all the way to the bank, as they say.
Yeah, so it seems to me that system will have to collapse of its own weight. But if it doesn't, what's going to happen is it's going to be the model system for a banker monopoly.
I think the term
empire.
Bank occupation describes it.
Right.
Literally, bank is taking control of the world. There is no power more powerful than money power. It literally is everything. I mean, the simplest way to describe it is to compare it to air in our lungs or blood in our veins. I mean, without a money supply, you can't pay your bureaucrats, you can't fight wars, you can't grow your economy, you can't do nothing. You can't do nothing. So you need money. It's a supreme power, and everything gets involved in this. And as long as private interests control the nation's money, well, the old Rothschild quote, you know, the only power you need is the power of money. You can tell governments to take a hike, and they'll have no choice but to do it.
Mm-hmm. And now they're even, like, the bus company can refuse your legal tender. So you're almost forced to have a credit card. And once you're in that credit card system, you're paying interest every time you use the card, whether or not you pay. Most people think, well, if I pay my balance at the end of the month, I don't pay interest. But in fact, the merchant has to raise his prices to cover the fees that he has to pay to use the credit card, and he's not allowed to have two prices, one for the credit, or he wasn't until recently. I guess there was a lawsuit about that, but you're supposed to have the same price, whether it's for credit card or cash. So everybody's paying for the fees of the credit card company, which they get fees at both ends of this trade. For what? For all this electronic money it's all computerized. I mean, there's nobody sitting there doing physical work to get these trades to happen. And they're not even taking a risk, really, because they're not even advancing real money. I mean, you're basically funding your own credit card. You're just funding it with your own credit. You've signed a promissory note when you signed up for the credit card, and they're just giving an advance against your own credit, which is then is paid off at the end of the month. So the whole thing is a huge bleed on the whole economy. 40%, according to Margaret Kennedy of Germany, 40% of everything we buy goes to interest. A huge percentage, and that's because at every level of production, producers fund their businesses on credit. They have credit lines because they have to pay workers and materials before they have a product to sell. And if you add up all those businesses in the whole chain of production of a product, it comes out to 35% to 40%.
That really is a shocking number. There's another shocking number, and I don't know the percentage, but when you deal with, say, a mutual fund company, or if you pay a load, or there are so many ways that the company can extract credit from their shareholders, and it adds up incrementally over time. So you may think you're paying a very low percentage in interest, but as it compounds over time, it's a much greater percentage, and they're taking a huge pound of flesh out of you. And most people, it's coming out, and most people don't even know what's happening. They don't understand it. And the same is what you just described, Ellen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and poor people that don't even have regular. This is an argument for a postal bank. They don't even have checking accounts, so they're paying huge sums just for an ordinary transaction to pay their bills or whatever. They have to pay these huge fees, and of course, to get a loan, they're paying payday loan rates. So that's why. We need something like the Reconstruction Finance Corporation, or we need a development bank. Development banks used to be big, but they were to serve the third world, and so they were a first world country having a development bank in the third world, and because they had all the economies of scale and they could get money for virtually free, like big banks can, from each other, they could get liquidity easily, and they had the guarantee of the big first world government. They didn't have to worry about advertising, fees, commissions, bonuses, all that. They could operate very cheaply. So they could go into third world countries and make loans for things that needed to be done, but an ordinary bank wouldn't make that sort of loan. We need that right here in the U.S. We need a development bank or a bank that's there to serve the people, to make loans to businesses, to homeowners, very cheaply because they're a great big bank guaranteed by the government. And this could be done, and it has been done, like in Germany, but that's part of the whole EU thing, that now they're forcing the big German public banks, the Landesbank, and they're forcing them off. They're not allowed to use their government guarantees for capital. So they're having to come up with capital like everybody else. Well, imposing this new capital requirement on banks that didn't have it before is just like what happened to the Japanese banks in 1988 when the Bank for International Settlements broke them by raising the capital requirement. It will just break the Landesbank. And that's what they're trying to do, is break the public banks. Fortunately, it doesn't affect the small public banks, the Sparkassen. And they're the ones that actually fund. They're, you know, like local community public banks that fund their local businesses. They don't have to worry, but they don't even operate on, they don't operate, they don't have any form of insurance, but they're so solid, lending right there in their community to their own, to businesses in the community, that they don't have to worry about this. They're actually self-funding small operations that get credit into the economy, and it works.
Oh, it sure does work in Venezuela, and I imagine some other countries too. But I've written very briefly, not detailed on how they do it, but very briefly, that to help small business in Venezuela, part of their system, very, very, very progressive system, they advance microcredit, low interest microcredit loans. So ordinary people, you want to start a small business. In America, you want to start it. If you have a small business, the deal is they want to crush it and put you out of business. So the big boys get bigger, in Venezuela under this system, Bolivarianism, call it anything you want, a progressive system, small business is encouraged. If you have one, they want it to grow. If you don't have one and you want to begin one, you're encouraged to go ahead and do it. So you've got this marvelous system, and the government will afford low interest microcredit loans. It's marvelous. So it helps grow the economy. Venezuela is a prosperous country. If you read official reports on the economy, they'll say they're struggling, they're doing this, they're doing that, they're doing something else. The economy is prosperous. It has not had a recession during the hot. They might have had one bad year. But of course, they greatly benefited by oil revenue. But the economy is responsibly run, and it really helps the big companies and the smaller ones. And if it could happen in a tiny country like Venezuela, just a fraction, my goodness, the size of the economy, a fraction of America. Their GDP, maybe about $400 billion, where the U.S. is something like $16 trillion. Well, if you could do it in a tiny country like Venezuela, why can't you do it in a country like America, where you can literally create all the money you want, and if you want to use it to grow the economy, you can do it. But it's not done. Mm-hmm. Again, so frustrating, and very, very aggravating. It certainly gets me angry, Ellen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was just reading where the Chinese are buying up America. Pretty much they're buying up real estate all over the place, like whole communities of real estate to set up little Chinese communities. And they're doing it with our dollars. So you can make a case. They subsidized their own exports to make sure that everyone in the world would buy their exports. So what do they get in return? They get our dollars. Now, you might think, well, what do they want our dollars for? They don't want our products. What do they want our dollars for? But it gives them a great deal of leverage over us. It's a way of conquering the world by exports. If you subsidize your exports so that everybody else buys them, then the dollars flow into your country, and then you can use the dollars for the big things that you really want, like real estate and big businesses.
Oh, indeed so. Indeed so. Ellen, we've got a couple of minutes before the end of the program. Final thoughts.
Well, I did write a couple of other articles in the last month. There are other ways that we could fix the monetary crisis. One would be, it seems to me, if you have to deal with that shadow banking system, the only way you can clip the wings of that thing is with a financial transaction tax. And they're actually talking about that in Europe. It's quite possible. I mean, we have a tax on everything else we buy. Why is it that the purchase and sale of financial products, as they say, which they insist are products and are part of the GDP, why aren't they taxed? We could just have a teeny weeny tax on all those trades. It wouldn't hurt ordinary trades at all. What it would hurt are those computerized high frequency program trades that are skimming profits off the stock market. That was one. And the other is that the whole, the Hurricane Sandy hasn't been repaired. The damage has not been repaired. And in North Dakota, when they had a similar flood, it was instantly repaired, and it was because the Bank of North Dakota stepped in to do it.
Well, they sure did.
I
think you may have written about it. I wrote about it, too. Again, when you do things right, you can get problems fixed. Ellen, we are fast running out of time. It's been another great hour, much, much too fast. I look forward to getting you back again next month. The moral of the story, always, when it comes to the economy, are so many things. If you do it right, things work. If you do it wrong, bad things get worse and worse and worse. Ellen, I look forward to getting you back again. Many, many thanks, as always. Join us, of course, every weekend, Saturdays and Sundays, 1 p.m. Eastern Time. We're on Fridays at 11 a.m. Eastern Time. You'll always get programs like this. You'll hear major issues discussed, what you need to know. You'll get nothing but the truth. That's all you'll get on PRN. That's all you'll get on this program. I urge you, listen, learn, tell others. There's only one way we're going to change the world. Only we can do it. It'll never be done any other way. And mark my words, there's no question. We can do it if we want to do it. I work at it every day. I hope everybody else will too. Join us.
This is PRN.FM. PRN.FM. The number one station for progressive minds. Progressive minds.